Of course, I'm talking to you because the Capitol are going to be running some films which they call the best films you've never seen, and that's what they're calling it. And the film that they're showing is The Devil's Playground, which is your first film.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, and I really wanted to know. I really want to know how you had the audacity in 1971 to make a feature film in the first place in the Australian context.
Well, it took me 5 years to get to make it. I was running a film company called The Film House, and I wanted to make feature films, and I was trying to think of what to make it about, and I suddenly thought, well, the monastery is something, a world that people know nothing about. And you get all kinds of personalities in there, plus you get the kids who are training to become Morris Brothers and their complexity and puberty and all that stuff, and then you see what they might become. And I just thought, wow, that'd be a good film to make. So I set about writing it, thinking I'd make it next week, and it took 5 years.
Well, in that period of time, there was a pretty strong culture cringe in Australia, but also this burgeoning belief, self-belief that we could do things. You were part of that wave.
In Victoria there were quite a few of us, and there were some in New South Wales as well, and at that time the Actors and Directors Guild of Victoria to run an experiment which ended up as a film called Libido, based in four parts, one of which was mine, called The Priest. So we were starting to find ways to get to make stuff, fortunately, we were able to find from the federal government some money, but most of the money was mine and friends of mine and clients of mine. But it just took a while.
Yeah, right. I mean, you started off making money as a advertising person, didn't you?
Correct, yep.
Yeah.
I started in an advertising agency, and then I went into a film company, and yeah.
So
Did
what was the seduction about film?
Look, when I was 15, I started going to see what we laughingly call continental films in those days. At 15, I think I was going for the wrong reasons. I thought I'd see a bit of sex and a bit of nudity, which at that stage in Australia would have been rare. But what I found was these wonderful films about worlds I knew nothing about, subjects I wouldn't have thought of. Plus, you always found something of yourself in there to identify with, that the world's not that different in many ways. So I just became, I guess, obsessed. With wanting to contribute to that. And that's part of why I chose Devil's Playground the way I did. So,
Are you from a Catholic background then?
Yes, I went to boarding school from the age of eight.
Yeah, right. Oh,
And,
you're a lucky
but,
boy.
but Devil's, yeah, not that lucky. But
Yeah.
then I went to the monastery when I was 13. So Devil's Playground is, we like to say semi-autobiographical.
It is a very seductive idea to try and put into a creative form things that you've learned in your own life. But actually, it's a much harder proposition, isn't it? What did you find when you were writing the script?
No, I just tried to see the complexity of it all. And being that age and being sort of taken out of the real world, so so that and forced into a kind of purity situation where, you know, they were making you shower behind shower with your togs on, you know, get undressed behind dressing gowns and stuff. And all this did was just create a really perverted kind of attitude to things. And I'd come from boarding school, you know, as I said, at the age of eight, you know, you never did any of that at boarding school. It didn't exist, you know. It was just somebody thought that this was I don't know, a way to approach religion, you know, which is just silly.
Yeah, it's such a curious thing to look back in time at how oppressive and crazy Australia was at that period that your film was made.
Yes. You know, things were starting to open up. Things were starting to change. The sexual revolution hadn't reached Australia yet. But we were starting to discover the value in our own stories on stage, in music, in television. And, you know, so we were starting to get confidence in our art as well. It all coincided, which I thought was, and in fashion, you know. It wasn't in isolation, but it was a sweeping change. And even in advertising, instead of having to imitate American commercials or English commercials, we were starting to speak to people in our own language, you know, appeal to what appeals to us, you know. So it was a whole movement, really.
Well, were you really surprised at the effect that your film had? Because it won an AFI award, didn't it?
Yep. Won a few, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
I was pleased. I was excited. But, you know, I had to distribute it myself. I had to got help from Philip Adams and introduced me to some theatre owners. So I wasn't going through distributors. We were distributing it, and it cost me as much again to distribute that as it did to make it. So, so I was working very hard day and night shooting commercials to pay for it.
That's really interesting. You know, the film itself has dusted off its hat to those films that you saw, those continental films, doesn't it? Tell us about the, it's all very well to say you're going to make a film, but lots of people make bad films. You have to have a sense of what you're shooting and the pacing that you're going to shoot it in and how you're going to edit it and what you want to say in those forms. Tell me about what you were doing when you were making that film.
One of the things I did, and this started when we were trying to work out how much it might cost us, and I looked at, I can't remember the name of the film, but there were two or three films. One of them was English. One of them was probably Italian or French. And what I did was I ran it. I didn't have the ability to sort of stop and start, but I ran it and ran it and ran it. And I looked at the cuts. So that, and I realized, oh, okay, that, and that. That's actually all one scene in one location. And I picked films that were of the sort of size and complexity that I thought ours would be. So I broke it down entirely into how many shots they would have done, how long it might have taken, all of that. It wasn't so much imitating what they were doing or anything like that, but was just getting a sense of structure at that point so I could cost it, right?
Yep.
But in, of course, in doing that, I learned quite a few things that I hoped to ignore and go past, you know. And by that I mean I didn't I didn't want to do the conventional cutting system. I didn't want to do the your close up, my close up, your close up, my close up, wide shot, medium shot. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to invent my own language. And with the help of Ian Baker, my cinematographer, you know, we sort of worked out that no movement unless it was motivated by someone or something in the story. That everything was in the service of the story, how to put across best all the things we needed to. Brian Kavanagh was our editor, you know, he was helping us in that too. And so the camera only moves when it's following someone or something, you know, that. So we were trying to not make you conscious of the filmmaking, but put you right inside the story of it.
Oh, fantastic. And, you know, that's the amazing thing. You go, I see quite a lot of films, and sometimes you go back and you watch films from other periods, and this is the opportunity in the best films you've never seen. It's just quite remarkable how artistic films from other periods are, because you get so used to what the conventions of vocabulary are. Now, it's a bit like the lobster in the pot, really. You know what I mean? Like, it's really exciting to go back and watch other films.
Yeah. And also, hopefully, you do it in a way that it doesn't date. You know, a lot of English films, certainly from periods past, always picked up on what the trends of the moment were. And they went even more trendy. They exaggerated those trends. So when you look at them now, they're dated.
Yeah.
They're extremely dated. They're curious pieces, but they are dated. You know?
And very hard to watch.
I didn't. Yeah, again, I didn't want that to happen as much as possible. You know.
Well, you've obviously succeeded, or they wouldn't be playing it again, right? another thing that I'd really like to know is you've succeeded in making this film. You've been brash enough to stand up there and say, I can make a feature film and it's Australian. And this is in a time when Australia didn't really have its cultural voice. And then it's a great success. How did that affect the sense of Australia getting its cultural voice, do you think?
It was one part of it. You know, you had Peter Weir making Picnic and Hanging Rock and Cars That Ate Paris. You had Tim Burstall doing his thing. You know, there were, as I said before, we were emerging in that direction, even in advertising. So it wasn't in isolation. Various of us gave one another the courage to believe in ourselves and go forward.
It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the hard part's getting the money.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask you the other question, which is it was in tandem with people like Philip Adams, who was canny enough to realise that legislation was required.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, we went from the Experimental Film Fund to the, I think, the AFDC or something like that it was called. So we got, there was money. And I wasn't getting any, by the way. Even though I was the top in advertising and industrial documentaries and PR documentaries, for which I'd won countless awards, when I was applying, they were not going to give me any money because I hadn't done a film. Who had done a film? You know, it was just weird. And somebody said to me, your problem is you're not being political. And I went, I have to play politics to get money? I didn't understand any of that. So I wised up and I sort of said to the body at the time, hey, listen, I can hit the newspapers, I can put my record out there for everybody to see, and I can say, you're not supporting me. What are the reasons I'm going to give them? You know, and guess what? Suddenly I got some money. And I thought that was crap, frankly. And there's still some of that going on today. They don't support people who going to do their second or third film. They don't help develop careers. They go for just give somebody a new chance, give a new person another new person, and it's a little bit so they can kind of control it. It's just weird.
I'm really interested in the Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, because the Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith was one of those films that brought Indigenous faces and story to the Australian screen. I think that was probably the most shocking film for white Australia.
Yeah, it was. It's probably why they didn't go to see it at the time.
Oh, really? I thought it was an amazing film.
Yeah. Well, it did. You said it. It shocked people. And in fact, you know, the Herald Sun just kicked the hell out of it. The whole of the second page, and about a third of the, you know, talking about the violence and the Aborigines.
It's based on a true story.
Yeah, that's right. And it was a lot to take in and confronting on many levels. And I think the opinion of it now is quite different, of course.
Why did you decide to make it? How did you know about that story?
Well, I got involved with Tom Keneally I was previously saying we did this experiment of getting people to write for film but write for other media. And Tom wrote The Priest for me, which was part of the portmanteau film called Libido. And I met Tom, and he was writing it, and he told me about it at the time. And there were some images in it that just fascinated me. And I went, oh, my God, I got to read this. I got to do this. I was stimulated by the possibilities. And he had other people offering him money and everything, but somehow I managed to talk him into giving it to me for very little money. So.
Well, magnificent. You did a great thing by making that film, I'll have to say. I think that was the beginning, the culture wars, as it were.
Yeah. It had its detractors, even in the First Nations community, although I think that's not the case anymore. And weirdly enough, and here's the really sad thing, because, you know, I didn't make that without advice, you know, from all the right people culturally. But if I was making that today, I probably wouldn't get to make it, because any funding for that money in this day and age, unless there was a First Nations person directing or photographing or something, you know. But, you know, sometimes you do things from when you're in your own world and you see the warp and weft and you feel it and have a different sense. Sometimes you do it from outside your world where you can see it in a different way and more objectively and probably hitting on the highlights that most people don't notice when they're inside the world. But you've always got to take the advice of the people you're doing it about. I made a film in Japan based on baseball. Did I know anything about baseball? No. But did I get a hell of a lot of experts to educate me? And then could I look at it in a fresh way that they wouldn't be able to? Yes. And we are stifling that kind of thing.
Interesting. That is very interesting. What did you think? Did you see the film Nightingale?
Yeah, I did.
What did you think?
I liked it.
Yeah, so did I. It was very freaky.
Yeah, very powerful, yeah.
Yeah.
I liked it. Yeah, no, absolutely. It was a good one. And it's like Nitram.
Nitram? Yeah, that's really, really good.
What a good film that is. And of course, nobody wanted to fund that bloody movie. And
really?
That's just wrong. That's just, yeah, because, oh, you know, you shouldn't be writing about this stuff or what, you know. Why? You know, that's an incredibly important subject done incredibly well. And they were all scared of it, the funding bodies. They ran from it like crazy. You know, and they had to make the film under the most exacting circumstances, and it's just wrong. Support people. Support the good ideas, the game ideas, the ones that are going to challenge you.